From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, criminologist Sheila Balkin and addiction specialist Bob Timmons talk frankly about keeping stars gone wild, out of jail, and on the road to recovery. Plus, in Hollywood, who gets paid what and why? We'll talk money with former agent turned manager turned producer Gavin Pallone. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Often indicted, never convicted, it's The Business from NPR. Last week, the New York Times unmasked the identity of a very mysterious and suddenly very rich new author supposedly named Jordan Ainsley. Ainsley took Hollywood by surprise last month, after a five-day bidding war over his unpublished manuscript, The Passage. The manuscript ultimately sold to Fox and director Ridley Scott for $1.75 million. Per The Times, it's, quote, a futuristic fable about death row inmates transformed into vampires by a government-spawned virus. Literary agent Ellen Levine said she advised the author, whose real name is Justin Cronin, to send out the book under a pseudonym because he won the Penn Hemingway Award for his 2001 short story collection, Marion O'Neill. She, quote, didn't want him to be typecast as one kind of author, unquote. Though it's unclear whether by that she meant he was embarrassed about writing such schlock, or whether he feared that Hollywood wouldn't buy a vampire movie from some highfalutin word-making person. Meanwhile, SpongeBob SquarePants, ask not for whom the Krabby Patty tolls. It tolls for you. Last week, cable channel Nickelodeon said it would no longer allow its cartoon characters, like SpongeBob, to be licensed for unhealthful food products, responding to congressional and FCC concerns about the marketing of junk food to kids. Starting in 2009, Nick characters on food packaging will be limited to, quote, products that meet better-for-you criteria, as established by marketing partners in accordance with government dietary guidelines. Almost in the same breath, Nickelodeon announced they just happened to be launching two new networks, at least one of which will be advertising-supported. One might expect that they'll be carrying plenty of ads for products which are definitely not better for you. Finally, speaking of the ill effects of junk food, folk punk act Violent Femmes last week found themselves with a bad case of sour stomach, brought on not by fast food, but a fast food promotional deal. Femmes bassist Brian Ritchie sued the band's lead vocalist Gordon Gano last week, saying that Gano had ruined the band's reputation by allowing its signature hit, Blister in the Sun, to be used in a Wendy's hamburger commercial. Ritchie also claims he was deprived of credit on other songs and a proper accounting of the band's earnings. Attorneys said Ritchie's suit was filed after he refused to accept Gano's final counteroffer of a Wendy's double baconator, Biggie fries, and a Frosty. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, getting green in Hollywood. And we ain't talking eco-friendly here. But next, life after Life in the Fast Lane. On previous shows, we've talked about the importance of damage control after a celebrity gets arrested. But for stars gone wild like Paris or Lindsay, the court of public opinion may be the least of their worries. The real court system, and hard time, may be awaiting celebs who've been caught driving under the influence, possessing drugs, or charged with other criminal offenses. While the PR people are spinning the press, defense attorneys often call on Dr. Sheila Balkin to help spin the judge. A sociologist by trade, Dr. Balkin's job is to convince the court that jail time may not be the best option for troubled talent. Often, she'll suggest alternative sentences, including specific programs of public service and rehabilitation. Balkin often works with addiction specialist Bob Timmons, who provides counseling and guidance and even plays babysitter to the stars. Dr. Sheila Balkin, Bob Timmons, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Doctor, your website says that your main goal is to humanize a client before the court. How do you do that?
The very most important part of both of our work is to get the trust of the client, because no matter how famous a person is, generally speaking, the true story has not been told. And so you have to gain their trust, have them tell you their secrets that they have never told anybody.
How do you do that?
Getting their trust has to do with allowing yourself, in much of the time, to become vulnerable, maybe not the first session I have with somebody, but the second, I'll start out by telling them my story, which then makes them feel a little bit more vulnerable and okay with talking about some of their stuff.
Have you had issues with addiction?
Yes. Mm-hmm. 32 years clean and sober. So I also know the demons that people have that live within them around addiction problems. But what happens with a celebrity quite often is they, if they're an actor, they take on these different roles. If they're a musician, they take on being who that musician is. And somewhere along the road, they'll come and ask me to help them find out who they really are again. They've lost themselves.
Yeah, Peter Sellers, I think famously, you know, someone asked him who Peter Sellers was, and he said, well, he's the guy who gets the checks. How does the process change when you're dealing with a celebrity as compared with Joe Schmo, let's say? What's different about it?
In your typical intervention or a situation, you know, the family could intervene, an employer could intervene. There are all these systems set up to intervene and get a person to go to treatment. Now, with a celebrity, you got to throw the word intervention out because you go to him and he says, well, that's really nice. You're fired at no cost to himself. So the challenge is to find a way to climb underneath all of that and get into him emotionally, get into his feelings, to get him again vulnerable and start talking about what the truth is.
Dr. Balkin, when you approach a court, when you have a client who's already been charged, frequently, especially if it's a celebrity client, their perception has already been established in the media, people's perception of them, whether it's because of a role they played or incredibly heavy coverage of whatever peccadilloes they've gotten themselves into. How do you humanize someone before the court?
The first thing, going back to the issue of trust, is to find out the whole story. People who are in trouble are in tremendous pain from their lives, and you have to get to the truth of that. And when you get to that truth, they really become more human, more vulnerable, and more sympathetic.
Walk me. I'm interested in the process by which, you know, you've sort of been injected into this person's life, regardless of whether or not they want you there, and you're asking them for the hardest truths they'll ever speak. What that process is like? What's the first meeting like?
You really need to get their attention in a dramatic way. I mean, there have been times where Bob and I all meet with someone for the first time, and the first thing he'll do is take off his shirt because he has all these tattoos, one with gang insignia showing where he's come from. And it's just a dramatic way of us introducing ourselves. We'll bring something up that's just extremely vulnerable and real. We get right in there, right into the pain. We go right for it.
Do you ever take cases, or do you ever find yourself with cases where it's clear to you that the celebrity is just not going along with this, that they might be, you know, meeting with you because they don't want to lose their livelihood or because their attorney has said you have a 3 o'clock meeting with Bob and Sheila, but that they see you as an apparatchik rather than a lifesaver, and that they're just, you know.
Quite constantly. I mean, it's kind of the only reason they're doing it is because they want to go still stay on the television show. And it takes some time for addicts to really make that decision and that they want to do something and make a change in their life.
Bob, you're an addiction specialist. You're a former addict or a recovered addict. I'm not sure what the proper term is. Do you get lied to by addicts?
No. And the only reason I could say no with confidence is I hopefully could say this, I have a really good bullshit detector, having been a heroin addict and been in prisons. In my own intuitiveness, I've been doing this a long time. A couple times I'll think, oh, maybe I'm wrong. And then I hang in there and sure enough, I was right.
Being lied to is different from being deceived, though. I mean, I guess what I was asking is not can you be tricked, but rather do people attempt to trick you? And I guess the answer is
yes.
From your answer, yes.
Yes, yes it is.
What right. are some of the tricks? I mean, for instance, I remember some case with Tom Sizemore and a drug test. I don't know if you recall that.
The penis that he had made from special effects, that trick, or he had a bunch of tricks.
You're not kidding, are you?
Yeah, no, he really did.
So he had a prosthetic penis.
Yes.
To pass, mm-hmm. what, someone else's urine?
Yeah, clean urine.
Uh-huh.
Tom had a whole list of tricks, and he's going to stay prison, so.
What are some of the attempts to game the system or to deceive you that you've seen?
There's nothing. I'm fortunate because mine's very on the table. I do urinalysis out of my office, which gives the results within 3 minutes. I tell them what 12-step meeting to meet me at and when to come back for an appointment. So if they're not doing those things, I know right away things aren't going good.
I'm talking with Dr. Sheila Balkin and Bob Timmons. They often work together for celebrities in trouble with the law to keep them out of jail and on the road to recovery. I'm curious, you know, this is a town that really will let you do just about anything so long as the grosses are high or the ratings are coming in where they should be. If you think that this is a town that produces more narcissism or more monstrous behavior than the average when it comes to addiction?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I think a lot of that's based on the money factor because there are a lot of people that, you know, you have that level of the celebrity, and then you have the next level, which is all the people that are their support team. You have a manager, you've got an accountant, you've got this whole team of people, and they don't want to see the party stop. So it's easy for them to want to kind of not be confrontive or interfere in any way.
Brew a pot of coffee and get them on the set.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I'm wondering if you think that the celebrity coverage that we've seen, this sort of 24/7 Chihuahua cam on Paris Hilton's dog and so on, and especially the coverage of these celebrity DUI cases, whether it's Mel Gibson or anything else that's come down the pike, whether it's caused rehab to lose its efficaciousness as a treatment option for you, that the courts are, you know, seeing several high-profile people treated as a joke and don't want to be caught out prescribing rehabilitation to someone that the feeling should be just lock them up. Has rehab lost its usefulness as a tool because of the coverage it's gotten?
The shift is, I think, the most difficult client to take to court is the one takes to court, and that is the celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Because more focused on them, more people are looking at them. More people want to know what the judge is going to do. He's got the whole world watching what his sentence is going to be.
Sheila, what do you think about that? Is it harder to ask for rehab when you've got a celebrity client?
Well, at this point in time, I think because of what you say, there's so many rehab centers, the courts are really become very educated about alcohol and drug addiction. The judges know it. In fact, there's drug courts that only deal with that we're very involved with. And I think that the judges are pretty sophisticated at this point in time about what it takes to get sober, to be in recovery, to work a program. And if a celebrity is really at that point where they're willing to work their recovery, work a program, chances are a judge is going to let them have that chance. Now, if they relapse over and over and over, it's going to be that much harder to get a judge to give them that chance. But I wouldn't underestimate the judge's education about what it is to be in recovery.
Does the current criminal justice system, as it's functioning, treat celebrity better or worse for being celebrity?
I think they treat them worse. And it's because, again, everybody's watching. So politically, they don't want to be nice to the celebrity when they're doing a stiffer sentence to the next person that comes in. I think what good judges try to do is take each individual like they're supposed to and do what they feel is the right thing based on the factual basis of the case, information given to them. But I always say, rather not go to court with a celebrity than a regular person because you are getting that special attention.
Sheila?
I think that at one point in time, it was an advantage to be a celebrity when you have a problem, when you're charged with a crime. At this point in time, I think it's held against a person. They're treated unfairly, harsher. That's what I'm seeing more recently.
I remember going to court with one of my clients that there are two men who had the worst pictures you ever want taken of you at a DUI arrest. And one of them, we went to sentencing, and the judge, being mindful and kind, put us in the jury room so we wouldn't have to be out there when the media staring at us. And I actually watched him make a date with a very cute DA. So that was like the one sample of that.
Does this client's name rhyme with Ick Ulti?
I was amazed. I said, he's really a good actor. He just turned the charm on.
I remember a time I had this is a number of years ago, I had a well-known actor as my client on a violent offense. And he was facing charges whether or not he was going to get bail or not. In other words, is he going to be locked up during the process of his case or was he going to be out? And I had to put together a bail report for him. We went into court and we had with us probably close to a dozen other very well-known actors who were there to support him. And the bailiff and everyone else in the courtroom was very interested in getting autographs from all these people. And so that's the way it was. I imagine that today that might still go on, but it would be handled differently. I see actors today or celebrities today as being penalized harsher for their occupation, their profession.
In the sentences, too.
Yes.
We only have about 20 seconds left here. I want to ask you if there's a particular favorite story of yours that I'm remiss in not having asked you about that you would want to share, you know, success stories or just hilarity and abject disaster, whatever.
Yeah, kind of one of my favorite ones, no names, but I'm hired here. I meet him here, and I'm hired here and flown to Paris. And I'm with probably one of the biggest rock and roll bands in the world. It's early 90s, and I'm up in the singer's room. And we order room service to eat and get to know each other. And they bring it, they pull the things off, and the guy leaves. And he says, you heard me say I wanted mustard only. They didn't bring no mustard. Go get me some mustard. And I said, I don't go get the mustard. You have to find somebody else to go get the mustard. So I think with celebrity or non-celebrity, you're going to be a father. You're going to be all those little boundaries over and over and over again that need to be made to keep everything going in a good way.
I think that I can't really say it's a favorite story, but I think that when you reach that point with somebody who you've known as an icon in the world and you start to talk to that person and they start to trust you and you really start to see them, sometimes a lot these people will be known as some name that they've taken on for the stage, and we go back to calling them by their real name, bring them back to reality, which they haven't been called by anyone but their mother in so long, right? And I think that it's that moment in time with these people where they start to really become real and get back in touch with who they are. Those are my favorite moments.
Sheila Balkin is a criminologist, and Bob Timmons is an addiction specialist. They joined us in our studios in Santa Monica. Bob, Sheila, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, even Woodward and Bernstein would find it hard to follow the money in Hollywood. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Everyone can agree that there's lots and lots of money floating around Hollywood. But with the giant numbers bandied about, the Baroque contracts, and the positively Clinton-esque parsing of the word profit, it's a bit hard to know who's getting paid what and why. To try and unravel this mystery, we have Gavin Pallone. Gavin's been on almost every side of the equation. He was an agent at United Talent, then a manager, and now a producer of TV shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and films like Panic Room.
Gavin Pallone, welcome to the business.
Thank you for having me.
With all the long contracts, the middlemen, the residuals, the complexity of accounting, the mirrors, the smoke, does anyone in Hollywood really know how much they're being paid?
You know, the people who make the most money usually have legions of people who are supposed to handle that for them. And I think, to be honest, it cuts both ways. I mean, I think that there are people who – I think the studios don't handle it right on their end frequently, meaning like they'll overpay sometimes. I've been overpaid. I'm not going to say when, but I've been overpaid before. And I know I've been screwed, and I looked at the analysis of whether I should go after it or not, and the lawyer said, you know, it's so sketchy and you'd have to spend so much time, you know, forensically trying to find the money. It's not worth it. So – From my perspective, it's just sort of, I hope it evens out in the end.
So when we see it reported that so-and-so is getting $9 million or $8 million or $20 million or whatever the amount is there ever any way to tell if that's true?
Is there any way for you to tell? Probably not, but they can tell if they're getting that amount of money. And the top people get it. I mean, they really, you know, I was a talent agent for a long time and worked at a big agency, several big agencies. The checks come in, and they take, you know, the talent agency takes their cut and sends it off to the business manager, and they take their cut, and the lawyers take their cuts. But the fact is, it starts off at whatever that number is, and plenty of them make $20 million. The thing that's not talked about as much is that $20 million is against a back end participation, and if that movie's successful, it can be, you know, multiples of that $20 million. That
60, 80, 90,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely,
million dollars.
Sure.
Let's talk about the idea of a quote. And first of all, what is a quote in this business, and how does it help you? How does it hurt you?
Quote's just your precedent. It's what you got for something similar previously. And if your last project did especially well, you're hoping to increase from that quote. You're trying to get a better deal than what you received previously. If you've failed several times in a row, you're hoping to maintain that quote. But if the project is a little bit different, meaning like maybe it's a lower budget project, it's an independent project, or in the television world, it's on a cable network versus a big network. And the overall pie that the financing entity may see in revenue is smaller than typical for another type of a project, you may have to go under your quote.
So, I mean, when you're a writer or when you're an actor, say, having this quote, can it hurt you? Can you price yourself out of projects just by dint of what you've made previously?
That's about you. I mean, if you put it out there that you're not going to be cutting your quote, or your representatives don't make it known that in certain situations, when appropriate, you'll cut that quote, then yeah, you will. You'll keep yourself out of a project that might have been something that would have been good for your career and pleasurable to do. What I find is most people are willing to subvert their quote under certain circumstances. And pretty much in all of those circumstances, there is an upside if the project ends up being wildly successful.
You are in a unique position to talk about all of this, we should point out, because you were a talent agent for many years at United Talent Agency, among other places. You've been a manager of talent, also a producer of talent, which is to say you've kind of worked on both sides of it for just about everyone.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what does it cost to have an agent, a manager, an attorney all in?
Well, an agent is typically 10%. And a manager is another 10%. I mean, there probably are some that take 15, but that's old school. It doesn't really happen anymore. Now it's 10 usually. A big entertainment lawyer is 5, and a lot of business managers take a percentage as well. The truth is, and this is not admitted to everywhere, most of those are negotiable as well. If you have the leverage, which I don't, so I pay full freight. But if you're a heavy user, you can negotiate with all of those, I think.
We could imagine that, say, Steven Spielberg is not really paying 10% to CAA.
If he is, he's a sucker.
You heard it here first. Pallone to Spielberg.
But they'll never admit it. Nobody would ever admit that.
What are the costs of not having this team, having been a representative yourself? I mean, is it worth it, do you think?
The right people are worth it. There's no question. I think that the costs can be exponential. I mean, if that agent gets you that one project that takes you from being one level of a actor to being a big movie star, I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars because of that one opportunity. I mean, what would you say the value of 40-year-old Virgin is to Steve Carell? I mean, if that movie had not been made, yeah, he'd be on a TV show, but how much money is he going to make in movies over the next 20 years?
Tens of millions of dollars.
Hundreds of millions of dollars, I would say. And so whoever put together and helped to put together that opportunity, if you took them out of the mix, would it still happen? I don't know.
On a big, big, you know, blockbuster movie, what's everybody making? I mean, to break it out for me, like how much is a screenwriter getting? How much is a director making? How much is the producer making?
Well, it all varies because a nobody screenwriter can have a very big movie. Person writes a spec script and it gets to the right people and the movie gets made. Even though he's rewritten numerous times, the movie still gets made. That person, if they are just starting out, you know, they make maybe $150,000 up front and they make another $150,000 if the movie's produced and they never see any profit. And if it's a huge screenwriter, I mean, the very top guys who've had a bunch of things produced, you know, they maybe got as much as $3 million up front and are seeing another $1 million when it's produced, and they might see some real back end if the project's successful. The director is anywhere from scale, which is somewhere, you know, just under $200,000, to there are directors who are, you know, making as much as $20 million up front. But the key is that they're getting first dollar gross, which means that, you know, of every dollar that comes in, they get that percentage. And it's not atypical for those very top guys to be getting as much as $10 million up front against 10% of the first dollar gross, meaning once that amount of first dollar gross exceeds $10 million, they're collecting again. And if $200 million in rentals comes in and they had 10% of that, they're now at $20 million in total compensation on that movie. In terms of actors, it works the same way. And we all know that the top actors get 20 and some even get 25 against a back-end participation that could be, you know, between 10 and 20% of the first dollar gross.
Producers.
I'm not comfortable talking about that. Now, you know, the top guys, not the guys who are, you know, C-level mediocre guys like me, make, you know, a tremendous amount. $3 million up front against a back-end participation of maybe something like 5 to 7% of the first dollar gross. And a lot of those guys, meaning like Jerry Bruckheimer, Scott Rudin, Brian Grazer, those guys have multiple movies in the marketplace every year, 4 movies, 5 movies a year. So when you really add it up, they can make a tremendous amount of money, especially if one hits, and their back-end participation, which escalates as the movie becomes more successful, can yield, you know, tens of millions of dollars. They're all doing okay.
Gavin Pallone is the producer of movies like Panic Room and shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and Gilmore Girls. We joined him in his sparse offices in Beverly Hills.
Tell Me You Love Me, September 9th on HBO.
And he's also the producer of, well, you know. Gavin, thanks for being on The Business.
Sure.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.